Hello, friends of Soul Kitchen. Today, we're going to have a conversation with a very exciting guest. Her name is Jennifer Hill. I met her recently, actually, during a medicine ceremony in Portugal. She's an entrepreneur. She's a public speaker. She's very much interested in human connection. She has a thing for remembering birthday celebrations of people. And she also works with Deepak Chopra on some things. And today we're going to speak about human connection and life in general. How are you today, Jennifer?
I am so happy to be here with you, Jasper. I'm just so grateful for all the serendipities that brought us together for that ceremony.
That's amazing. And what I remember of you is when we first met, you asked me my date of birth.
August 19th.
And I said August 19th. And then immediately you knew some other people that had that same birthday. And it's for me actually the first time in my life that I met someone that, you know, focused on that birthday and then connected me to other people. So how did you, why do you do that?
When I was younger, Jasper, to me, it was like, you got a book on how to be a human being and you got a book on how to be a human being. And mine was blank inside. And this led for me, Jasper, to decades of misunderstandings, breakdowns in communication, and a lot of pain for me and the people in my life. So it was about 15 years ago that a business coach came into my life who helped me to understand that we're all designed differently as human beings. And one of the many things that I use to help understand myself and others is numerology. I love numerology, astrology, human design, gene keys. We have our own system called OptiMatch or Om.app that measures how you're motivated and how your motivators align or misalign with another person. So something I began looking at about 10, 15 years ago now is numerology. So you may remember as well that you're a life path six. Mm-hmm. And my brain, which I only found out about 6-7 years ago, is high functioning on the spectrum, autistic, neurodiverse, whatever you prefer to call it. And how that shows up for me is I love patterns. I love it. It's like, ooh-wee. And so that's why I like to look for patterns, particularly in numbers, birthdays, and numerology. And for some reason, I was a kid in school who I loved like algebra and algebraic matrices and statistics. Like my brain just was like, ooh, bring that on. So I think there's always been that love of numbers in my life. And for some reason, I am more likely to remember your birthday than your face or your name. It's actually really embarrassing. Just the other day, I was with somebody who I thought was one person, and it turned out it was another person. It's something called facial dysplasia that sometimes people with autism can have. And it's quite frankly very embarrassing because I'll often run up and try to hug the wrong person.
So you love patterns and you love numbers. And relate to autism, what is kind of your strength and what has been your challenge related to autism?
Well, it's funny because I like to think of my purpose as helping every human being have a meaningful relationship with themselves and others. And so that was both my greatest weakness when I was younger because I was constantly not understanding how to make friendships, how to retain friendships. I hated myself, Jasper. I was bulimic from the age of 15 to 25. I would throw up sometimes 20, 30 times a day. I spent most of my late teens and early 20s steeped in self-loathing and just anger and bitterness towards myself and the world. And at that time, I did try to commit suicide 3 times.
Oh, wow.
So I just hated life. So at the same time, what was my greatest weakness as in my young adult life has now become my greatest strength. So autism challenged me to be able to understand how to communicate, how to love and understand myself, and how to appreciate that my brain works differently than, say, whatever a neurotypical brain might look like, and to embrace those changes. And I think that when we embrace the beautiful weirdness and strangeness and all the eccentricities in ourselves, that then extends the space for creating compassion for others. Because until we can first learn to love the quirky bits about ourselves that we hate, we're never going to be able to extend love to somebody else or compassion. So it's been my greatest joy and honor now to have been on this journey the last 6 years or so since I got diagnosed of coming out of the shell and stopping masking. Most of my younger life, Jasper, was spent just trying to fit in. I could mimic. So if I saw somebody do something, I'd be like, oh, that's what normal is, right? And so I'd try to pretend to be normal. And then it often occurred as robotic. I remember speaking of Deepak about 4 or 5 years ago when we, 4 years ago when we did one of our first episodes together. You should never read the comments of any show that you do. And it was a show that got tens of thousands of views on Facebook during COVID. And it literally said, who is that robot interviewing Deepak? So if I wasn't careful, I used to have what I called resting robot face, where I would often talk and look like this. And people would find me intimidating or not approachable. So now, thanks to my lovely vocal coach, Arthur Samuel Joseph, and many other wonderful teachers, I've learned how to put joy on my face and be more emotionally available and accessible to others and myself.
Wow, it feels like you've gone through some major changes and you've translated painful experiences into purpose. What touched me is the fact that you've attempted suicide 3 times. Can you reflect a bit on that experience, or how do you look back at that experience?
When I was about probably 17 years old, I don't even think I was 18. I left high school and went straight to college when I was 16. So I kind of had a little more flexible schedule. And I remember I was with some friends in the middle of the desert in California. And it was what most 17 or 18-year-olds would have found to be an amazing party, right? There's a party and there's all these friends we had there. And I remember sitting on a sand dune and just thinking, I'm never going to be normal. I'll never be able to say the right thing. Even today, to this day, Jasper, sometimes I'll be in a meeting with somebody or meeting someone for the first time. And because I said and did the wrong thing so many times when I was younger, even if you tell me to my face, oh, Jen, I love you, you're amazing, there's still a part of me that has this fear that I've said or done something wrong or weird or awkward. And as I sat on that sand dune when I was about 18 years old, I just remember this overwhelming feeling of dread and shame and lack of belonging. And I felt like I have no tribe. I have nobody who will ever understand me. And it was later that day that I went to try to take my own life.
Mm. Wow. That's very touching. And you said you didn't have your own tribe. You also felt you didn't have friends or...
I had friends, but I had friends at the level of consciousness where I was at, because all I knew how to do was to kind of mimic what other people did. I had a quote unquote best friend at the time who was popular and beautiful and could be a little bit challenging for people sometimes. So I thought, oh, if I'm a jerk, but if I'm pretty and if I dress right and say the right things, then maybe I'll be accepted. So all I knew how to do was try to mimic. And so when I look back, as many of us do probably in our late teens and early 20s, I had relationships, though the relationships I had were very superficial and based on looking good and partying. And, you know, so many of us do when we're 18 to 25 or whatever age we're at. Some of us never grow out of it. And it was only in my early 30s when I began meditating every day. I haven't missed a day of meditation for 12 years and studying Kabbalah and beginning my spiritual practices that all of a sudden the friends I had around me started to shift. Some of them fell away. And then the new friends that emerged, it's like planting seeds. And if you plant a seed in fertile soil, then all of a sudden the most beautiful thing can grow out of it. Yet often I was planting seeds in rocks when I was younger. And so nothing really grew out of it. And I stopped spending time with a lot of those people, and they're wonderful and I still hold them in my heart. But now I feel so grateful that I have literally hundreds, if not 1,000 people around the world who I actually consider friends. I remember somebody once said, Jen, I've never met somebody who has so many close friends. And it's because if you and I, just like you and I met, Jasper, if I have a conversation with you, nowadays I don't have conversations of, oh, look what a beautiful day it is. I have conversations about, hey, what matters to you? What makes you happy? And then I love to support. I see so many of us out there, Jasper, struggling with this loneliness epidemic. It's at an unprecedented rate of 24% globally in the last survey that was done. And anytime I see another human being, I know what it's like to feel lonely and to feel left out. And I do everything I can, providing tools, resources for resilience and understanding of self and others, that it brings me joy. So no matter any conversation I enter into, as long as I've slept enough, had enough water, taken care of my own well-being, such as meditating, I try to show up in every conversation to be of service to every person I meet.
So your purpose is to help people connect to themselves and to others, but in the past you felt lonely yourself. Can you remember when you started to translate that pain that you've experienced to your towards your purpose? It's probably not like maybe one moment, has been a process, but can you mention some highlights that you remember or wake up moments?
It's like popcorn. I remember I was in a personal development class many years ago, and the teacher said, you know, if you're cooking popcorn, you kind of have the oil and it's getting warmer, and then one kernel pops and then another kernel pops. And then eventually, a few minutes later, all the kernels start to pop. So throughout my early 20s, I had one woman who, when I was about 23 years old, looked at me. I was at the end of a personal development class where I had been particularly cantankerous and not happy and a bit of a jerk. And she said, "You are a nasty thing. You are one of the most powerful women I've ever met in my life. But you know what? You are like Godzilla walking through a city with a huge tail swing behind you, knocking down buildings wherever you go. You're using your powers to destroy other people." So that was one of my earliest wake-up calls. And then when my business coach, now co-founder of OptiMatch, Julian Adler, came into my life, people don't believe me when I say, "Hi, I'm Jennifer Cahill. I'm a recovering jerk. Nice to meet you." People are like, "No." They're like, "You meditate 2 hours a day. How can you be a jerk?" And I'm like, "I swear, God forbid you go ask my ex-husband, my friends at that time." I was such a shitty friend. Another popcorn moment for me, Jasper, was I remember I had a friend who was one of my oldest childhood friends I had known since I was about 10, 12 years old. And she had gotten to know through my first wedding one of my other best friends. They were both bridesmaids. And she said, "I need to have lunch with you." And it was a pretty big deal. She lived in San Diego. She came up to LA to have lunch with me. And she said, "We've been friends for a long time, and I need you to stop judging me and gossiping about me." And I was like, "What?" She said, "Yeah. Your other friend, our mutual friend, said that you often put me down when I'm not here." And I remember, Jasper, it was like a gut punch. And I took full accountability for it. I was like, "Oh my gosh, I'm sorry. You're right. I can see that." And so it's not just one moment. It's a myriad of moments. And the biggest thing that I would encourage all of your listeners and viewers to consider is that you might even think you have it all figured out, right? You're like, "Yes, I'm meditating, I'm praying, I'm taking care of myself, I'm elevating my consciousness," whatever that means to you, and you're still going to be human. Just the other day, I had a challenging conversation with my co-founder, Julian, who I love like a brother. We've known each other now like 15 years, and he helped me sell the first company. So he's been co-founder of the new company. And Jules and I got a call, and he was being, you know how somebody's like a little bit standoffish and his arms were crossed and he was like leaning back. And I know when people get upset with me, they call me Jennifer. Like a lot of my close friends, some people always call me Jen or call me some other name. But when Jules, my co-founder Julian, calls me Jennifer, I know I'm in trouble. When it's like, "Hi, Jennifer, what do you need today?" And I was like, "Ooh, what's going on?" So Julian said to me, he said, "Jen, we need to talk. I feel like there's something in the space between us." And I said, "Okay." And again, at my conscious level, I had no idea. And he said, "To me, it occurs for me that you're treating me like an employee rather than a partner, co-founder, and that you're not respecting me." And in that moment, so here's how it evolves over time, Jasper. Years ago, if you had said that to me before I had tools for self-regulation, like heart math and things like that, I would have done what many of us would have done. I would have gotten defensive. "How dare you? That's not true. I'm a good partner." And in that moment, instead, I dropped in. I did some heart-focused breathing to access my higher brain function and quiet that amygdala of, "Oh my God, I'm not safe." And then I immediately said to Jules, I said, "Jules, let me check." And there's something for your listeners who might not be familiar with it called muscle testing. So I can muscle test myself. My name is Jennifer. My name is Jasper. You let go of your hands if it's not true. And I said, "I am treating Julian like he's an employee." Now it's a no because I've done work on it. I'm not treating Julian with respect. Both are now no's. But I did that in the moment. And Julian was like, "Thank you. Thank you for acknowledging it." Because in that moment, I didn't realize that at a conscious level, I had no awareness of this. But at a subconscious level, he was 100% right. And somehow or another, I was carrying around a subconscious belief that he wasn't an equal. So we remedied it. And it was a beautiful conversation.
And why do you think at that time, you treated him as an employee? Like, what was the how did that happen?
Well, we knew what had happened, so then we dove into it deeper. How often does this happen to all of us as human beings, right? We have some sort of upset, and we had had an upset sometime in March or April of this year, and we had had a breakdown where I had felt betrayed in the moment, and he had said something that he didn't mean. He apologized again in that conversation. He's like, Jen, I'm so sorry. I can totally get it. But the moment I did realize that I had that limiting belief around him, then I was able to drop in and see that he and I had had a disagreement 4 or 5 months ago. And unfortunately, sometimes you're building a tech company. I don't know if you've ever done it. It's a lot of work. And you're just
like...
I've
never built a tech company, a travel company, but not really a tech company.
Yeah, I had never built a tech company either. And let me tell you, it's nonstop, Jasper. Part of your time, you're fundraising. Part of your time, you're developing technology. The other part of the time, you're trying to bring on clients and things. And so life happened and it slid under the rug. And I didn't realize it was still simmering under the surface. So the moment we realized that, we both apologized to one another. We both got back into a state of coherence, which is one of my favorite terms from HeartMath. And when we're in a state of coherence, that's where partnership can happen. That's where great things can begin to emerge.
It's thank you for sharing that. And you mentioned building a tech company, because your current company is called OptiMatch.
Yeah.
And what does OptiMatch do, or what's the purpose of OptiMatch?
My gift, Jasper, is connecting people. It brings me the greatest joy now that I've honed and fine-tuned this gift. It's become one of my greatest abilities, for lack of a better word. And so in the recruiting business that I sold in 2018, one of the reasons we got acquired is we created strategies and systems for aligning people, but it was all in my head. It was never a software. So when Julian came to me after we sold our last company and he said, Jen, why don't we create an algorithm that mirrors your intuition of how you match people? My head was like that little emoji head that went, what? Mind blown. I was like, I didn't even know that was possible because I didn't come from technology. So thanks to Julian's help and Moon Cho, who is our original co-founder who helped birth this idea, the three of us spent 8 months developing a set of questions backed by a complex mathematical formula that answers, what is Jasper motivated by? Are you motivated by fun? Are you motivated by facts? Are you motivated by accomplishing, getting things done? Or are you motivated by other people's needs? And then the way our formula works is it tells you with a high degree of certainty how safe you're going to feel working with someone else. Are you familiar with Project Aristotle from Google?
I've never heard about it. No, tell me more.
When I was training with HeartMath to become a trainer with them, part of the intense study we did was around the Project Aristotle. It was done in 2012, and Google set out to find out what is the number one factor in successful teams. And they thought it might be people who went out for drinks, people who were the same age, people who lived in the same area. They were wrong. After studying 37,000 people and 170 teams, do you want to know what the number one factor they found for success was?
I'm very curious.
Psychological safety.
Ah.
So that's what we've ascertained that we're really measuring is we started off testing it in marketplaces. So with coaches and therapists, we built our own marketplace of over 100 therapists and coaches. And we completed over 150 sessions. And early on in early beta testing, we got to an 87% satisfaction rate. Well, then the first time I ever went to pitch an investor about a year and a half, 2 years ago, the investor says, listen, I don't give a crap about your marketplace. However, if your formula is really as good as you say it is for matching people, you need to drop what you're doing and go out and create a white labeled version of this product that any company around the world can use for matching people. And so voila, out of that, our project was birthed called OptiMatch. And we spent another year and a half developing it. And last year, we've made it available to the public. So now we have consultants that use it for our leadership teams for seeing how teams match. We have hiring companies that use it, startups that use it for hiring internal team members. We have communities. We're in the process of onboarding an 8,000-person community where they use it to match their members to create greater happiness. In fact, one of the guys who's part of that community that we're onboarding sent me a WhatsApp message yesterday. And he said, Jen, I just want to thank you for creating OptiMatch. I just had my OptiMatch connection from this community called the Octopus Movement that we're both a part of that we're onboarding. And he said it was magic. And so many people are telling us this. So then that begs the question. This is not why we designed the software, Jasper. But it's funny, we have dating companies that want to use it. Mm. They're like, well, if you can match business people, and like we have outsourcing companies who use it to hire assistants and so forth to be able to tell with a high degree of certainty how well two people are going to match. But we've had a lot of dating companies say, hey, can we use this in dating? And ironically, we don't have a huge amount of people yet, like 1,500 maybe have answered our matching questions. Mm-hmm. However, of that, probably 50 to 100 happy couples have answered our matching questions, small sample size at this point, and about 70% do seem to match perfectly according to our algorithm. So who knows?
Oh, wow, that's amazing. And I'm curious, because you use this list of questions, but earlier you mentioned that you're also interested in human design and numerology.
Yeah.
So do you also include these factors, or are you focused on the set of questions?
It's a great question. As our COO, David Sauls, always reminds me, we're selling the cupcake right now. So we do have active clients who are using the product. It's ohm.app. But we're building the cake. So we're getting the recipe right to build the cake. Down the road, we may incorporate other things. Right now, it doesn't base any of that. We're honestly, Jasper, a little worried to mess with the formula because it works really well right now. Though for me, if I had it all my way, I'd love to add little layers in. So our co-founder, Julian Adler, is an expert at human design. He's the one who actually introduced me to it and completely shifted my whole perspective on understanding teams.
Because I also heard about you, when you hire people, you also use human design.
Yes.
And what is your own human design?
I'm a 6-2 projector. So for your audience, if they're not familiar with it, there are 5 types of human design. There's projectors, which is what I am, which make up 21% of the world. We need to be invited. So if you're out
like
there...
Like for the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. It's like literally, it drives me crazy being a projector. We literally have to sit on a mountain and meditate until somebody invites us. Oh, I got an invitation from Jasper today. I'll show up. And then ask ourselves, obviously, if it's in our highest and best good. Then you have 70% of the world, which are a combination of manifesting generators and generators, which are like the worker bees who are amazing and can produce. Like my husband's a manifesting generator, and manifesting generators and generators can work like 17, 18 hours a day. Both Julian, our co-founder, and David Sauls, our COO, are both generators. And those two can run circles around me. They're amazing. Then you have 10% of the population, which is what's called manifestors, which are the generals who tell you what to do and you just listen to them. They inform you. And then you have 1% of the world, which are reflectors. Hmm. And reflectors have nothing defined. So all they're constantly doing is reflecting energy back to you. Hmm.
So you have these 5 types, and you're a projector. You have to wait for the invitation. And you mentioned the 6-2. What does that mean?
So there's numbers 1 through 6. I am a 6-2. Sixes, thus everything we've talked about thus far, go through great hardships. Thank you for that little gift, universe. Fist bump the universe for that little friendly fire. So 6-2. So the 6 and 6-2 is the side that we have to go through challenges. Between the ages of 0 to 30, you go through such heartache, so many challenges, but there's a reason to it all. If we do the work between 30 to 50, I'm now 43, then you start to get perspective. And the whole purpose of being a 6 is if you evolve enough, you get to be a role model after the age of 50. And that's the goal. The 2 is the side of me that when I throw a party, I will spend time with everybody and then I will go hide for a half hour at a time. Mm. So the 2 is what's called the hermit. Mm. So I'm a 6-2, so I have this weird dichotomy where as much as I can enjoy a beautiful conversation, then I need to go meditate or spend quiet time by myself to clear my energy afterwards.
That's interesting. I'm a manifesting generator, so indeed quite productive. And then the 2-4, so I think it's a hermit opportunist.
Oh, you're the same as my husband. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's the same too. So the 4, I don't know if you know this, if anybody's told you, the 4 has the capacity to greatly influence your network. Mm. So anybody who knows you directly, Jasper, is going to be greatly influenced and impacted by what you share, just like this podcast, versus a 5. A 5 has a great impact over all of humanity. Regardless, they don't necessarily have to go through the same challenges that a 6 does, but most often a 5 is going to impact all of humanity in some way.
Well, yeah, I think it makes sense because with the podcast, and I like to influence people, connect people, but then my 2 is more the hermit side, like walking alone, like I've done the past days. When I discovered this combination, it helped me understand myself that I have a bit of both, you know, the hermit, but also the more networking side. Human design. So if you hire people and you find out about their human design, how do you make decisions based on that? Do you look what you're still missing in the company, or do you look whether it fits the role, or what?
No, when I used human design, so I'll give you a great story about that, actually. When Julian introduced me to it about 10 or 15 years ago, I had a person I worked with who was one of the very first employees I ever hired at my last company. And I was getting so frustrated. Now, keep in mind, this was my jerk days. So this is like the jerk period. Before I realized I was being a jerk, it was like kind of an evolution of realizing I was a jerk over time. And so this person, I was frustrated that this person wasn't moving as quickly as I wanted, returning calls as quickly. And so one day, Julian introduces me to human design. So she's already working for the company. And he says, great, let's do our human design. And it turned out she was a projector like me. And Julian pointed out to me, you have her in the wrong role. You're treating her like a generator or a manifesting generator, expecting her to produce work. That's not how she's designed. You're asking her to do something she's not capable of. What we need to do is to put her in a position where she can manage other people. And so fast forward, there were two things that happened. One, he helped me to understand her human design, being a projector, and told me to put her in a management role. But at that point, I was still a little bit frustrated and judgmental and so on and so forth. And so he says to me, Jen, what if the reason that she is a disappointment is because you are looking for her to be a disappointment? Well, no, excuse me, no. I have a list here of clients that did not get calls returned to, et cetera. So at the same time, Julian said, I want you to write down one good thing she is doing a day. You don't even have to tell her for 7 days. All I'm asking you to do is look for the good. And I can get into the neuroscience behind this afterwards if you'd like. And so for one whole week, I did this. And day one, I was like, Fine. I'll find something good she did. So I write down one thing begrudgingly. The next day it became easier. The next day she was doing amazing, Jasper. By the end of that week, she was kicking butt and taking names. I am so proud to say that not only did we move her into a management role, not only did she continue to do well past that first week, she went on to be the executive vice president of the company I sold and take it over for me after I sold it.
Oh,
and
wow.
She's still doing amazing. We're still in touch.
So you change something in your own approach by looking at the positives. And you mentioned that there's some neuroscience behind it. So tell me about that.
Yeah. So one of the things I love to share with people is the idea that every moment of every day, Jasper, we have 11 million, with an M, 11 million bits of information bombarding us per second at a subconscious level. But at a conscious level, do you want to know how many of those 11 million bits we're paying attention to per second?
Hundreds?
50 to 120 bits is what leading neuroscience tells us. So everybody wants to know, well, what the heck is doing the choosing? Out of 11 million bits per second, what's doing the choosing of those 100 bits? So the analogy I like to use, Jasper, is imagine walking through an infinitely large pitch black warehouse. You can't see anything. And all you have is a miner's helmet on your head with an itty-bitty little pen light. And the only thing you're going to see, Jasper, is if you look up, you'll see what's up. If you look down, you'll see what's down. And so too is our life. You wonder why people have upsets in their marriages, upsets in their friendships, upsets in their professional relationships. It's because somebody disappoints us once, and then that's all we're looking for. We're just looking for information to validate that, just in the same way I did. So I encourage people, look for the good in everything and everyone. That is one of my prayers I say every day. I say, universe, please let me look for the good in myself and others today.
I think it's a beautiful teaching there, to look for the good. And so these teachings that you mentioned about the neuroscience, is that also what you, because you work with Deepak Chopra, I think, and his team. What exactly do you do with him, and what type of teachings did you learn from him?
So I had no idea who Deepak really was. We had never crossed paths. I had never been a devotee of his or read any of his books. And really unexpectedly, in the end of 2019, about a year after I sold my company, I got invited to co-moderate a panel with Deepak Chopra and my favorite professor from college, Professor Don Hoffman, who at the time had written a best-selling book called The Case Against Reality, Why Evolution Hid the Truth from Our Eyes. So that first panel we moderated, I was getting ready for it. It was end of December 2019, and I had balls of steel, and I will tell you why. Because at that time, I had just started hosting a TV show, and I use this in quotations because I say that very loosely. It was more of like an internet TV thing, and it was called Awake TV, and I had a new show. And again, I'm going to put the show in quotation marks, right? And I had the balls. Something hit me like a ton of bricks, Jasper, that I had the gusto and the gumption. I called up UC Irvine, who was the one who was facilitating and asked me to speak at this panel. And I said, hey, can you tell Deepak and Don that I saved them a spot on this new show I'm doing called, I forget what it was called, Metaphysics or Regarding Consciousness, something like that. So I didn't know what to do. And then all of a sudden, a few days later, I get a call from Deepak's team saying, he'll meet you in studio. He wants this sort of car to pick up, blah, blah, blah. And next thing you know, I didn't even have a studio, Jasper. I had no studio. I had nothing. And so I had to pull it all together. And so that marked the first episode that Deepak Chopra and Don Hoffman and I did. And it became a series of 17 episodes that we've done called Conversations at the Intersection of Cutting Edge Science and Spirituality. And so we have done some fascinating conversations over the last 4 years. Don is the neuroscientist. If I could have done anything else, if I hadn't gone down the path of becoming a recruiter and an entrepreneur, I would have loved to have been a neuroscientist. That whole thing really sparks my interest. So Don was my favorite neuroscience professor in college and really the only lecture I remembered. And then he and I reconnected because of all of this. And fast forward, yeah, that's what kind of led me down this path of quantum physics, neuroscience, all of that, and to my own podcast, which is now called Regarding Consciousness, where I've interviewed Deepak and Don and many others.
So Don played the role of the neuroscientist, and what was kind of your role and Deepak's role in that team?
So for me, I was a facilitator and moderator. So I would just kind of drop into the consciousness and I would do two things. One, I would speak English for everybody who didn't understand. Because sometimes Don and Deepak, like Don's written this incredible mathematical formula on Markovian kernels and a new mathematical formula for consciousness. So Don's theory is that consciousness is fundamental and that space-time is not. And so I am very good at listening deeply and then helping dissect and make it more accessible to other people. So I love asking questions, and Deepak was bringing the spiritual side. So we had Don, who was a scientist, Deepak, who was the spiritual side,
and you're the
and
moderator.
Then I was the moderator facilitating between them.
And if you reflect on the 17 conversations, how would you summarize kind of the key teachings, which is probably hard? Or maybe can you give examples of a few teachings that you've learned or distilled?
There were so many deep topics that I knew nothing about. I am not a quantum physicist. I am not a neuroscientist. We did an interesting episode on special relativity. I almost gave up that day. I almost did not do that interview, Jasper. In fact, I have a funny story about it. Would you like to hear it?
Yes, I would like to hear it.
So this was about the fourth episode we were doing in the end of 2020. It was December. I was living here in Portugal. And that morning I woke up, Jasper, and the interview was going to be at my 10 p.m. here in Portugal. And I was like, I can't do this interview. I had been studying everything Stephen Hawking wrote for weeks, trying to understand special relativity. I had been watching everything that Deepak and Don had ever done. And the morning came and I said, I can't. I just can't do it. So I do my morning meditation. And immediately after my meditation, I talk out loud to what I consider God or source. And I said, God, I'm sorry, I can't do the interview with Deepak today. And without missing a beat, I hear, I'm what you would call clairaudient. I hear things. And I heard this voice say, ask Einstein. Mm. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? And the voice said, ask Einstein. He will explain everything you need to know 1 hour before the interview with Deepak. Go into a meditative state and Einstein will tell you everything you need. Now, at that point, Jasper, I was pretty far along in my spiritual journey. I had had a lot of mystical, wonderful things happen, but that was a stretch for me. So I was like, okay, sure. I'm clearly losing my mind. So that night, it's 9 p.m. and I go into my normal meditation. I do transcendental meditation. So I'm saying my mantra, I feel like I'm in a deep enough state, and almost like a little kid peeking at Santa Claus, I open one eye. I'm like, Einstein, Mr. Albert Einstein, this is Jennifer Hill here on Earth, and God said you could help. The most surreal experience I've ever had in my life, Jasper. I'm sitting there, dead sober, no alcohol, no drugs, nothing. and I start reverse swirling in my chair, and I drop out of space and time. And I am in a wormhole playing with Einstein, who is a ton of fun. I highly recommend your whole audience ask to connect with him. He was like, it was the most fun I had ever had in my whole life. So he starts like explaining special relativity equals MC squared, all that stuff to me. And I am just in this altered state of consciousness that I don't know how long I'm gone for. And I really didn't give a crap about coming back to interview Deepak and Don because it was so much fun. And it was one of my favorite interviews I'd ever done with the guys.
Wow, that's amazing. So basically what you did instead of worrying, you're going into meditation state and trusting, receiving the knowledge that you receive from Einstein and then entering the interview.
Yeah. And if you study spiritual disciplines, many people who are specialized in the Akashic records and fields, they will tell you that all the infinite knowledge is out there. It all exists. We just need the vessel or the capacity to tap into it. Now, years later, we did an episode around evolution. And it was funny, the universe and God did not tell me to reach out to Darwin, but it was hilarious. So I was like, oh, well, it worked last time with Einstein. I'll just ask Darwin. Darwin was a cantankerous old jerk who wanted nothing to do with it and was so pissed that everybody was questioning his formulas and stuff. And so it was so funny because I've since learned that I have this gift for something I call soul talking, which is really deeply hearing what matters to other people and understanding people's deepest desires. And so I use it in business. I use it for myself. It's been very powerful.
And how do you interview people, or what's your approach to interviewing?
I actually soul talk with them. So when I go into an interview with any of my guests, I surrender. The first thing I do before I go to the interview, just like you and I did before this one, I say, universe, please allow me to be a channel for your light and the light and wisdom of the masters and the Sadiqim, and let my words be your words. Let my ears be your ears. Let me just see and think and be with you the way, so that way I can see whatever and hear whatever needs to come out. And I also ask to never take or take energy from the audience. I ask that my energy always comes from source. And then when I do the interview, I actually go into a meditative state. So if I'm interviewing you, for example, I'm actually talking to you at the soul level to see what question to ask next and what question you do want to talk about, what question you don't want to talk about. And then I'm imagining talking to the audience's soul and asking what they want to know.
Wow. So you make the connection between interviewing and meditative state. And you've been meditating for 12 years.
Yeah.
If you look back at these 12 years, how has this shaped your daily life or your life?
I would say, Jasper, it's a combination of two things: meditation and heart-focused breathing. Meditation for me helped me to begin to regulate my nervous system. Not knowing that I was autistic until about 6 years ago, it turns out that I've talked to many friends and experts who are experts in psychiatry or coaches in this. The reason a lot of us who are on the spectrum or neurodiverse might have a hard time with others and situations is because we don't know how to regulate our nervous system. So when I meditate, all of a sudden, I'm more clear. I'm not as in my head. I'm more present. I also use that coupled with heart-focused breathing, which is a technique by HeartMath. I'm a huge devotee of what they do. I use heart-focused breathing with the clients that I coach and for myself every day. And just like I mentioned when there was that potentially triggering conversation with my co-founder, Julian, I used heart-focused breathing in that moment. So are you familiar with the three-brain system?
No.
I'll give you an example of this. A lot of us are familiar with our amygdala. Have you ever heard of that before? It's the part of the brain.
I heard about it, yes.
Yeah, it's like the reptilian brain, right? So essentially, we have three parts, Jasper, to our brain. We have the amygdala, which is that fight or flight side of our brain. I'm not going to survive, etc. Then you have the mammalian brain. Am I safe? Are you like me? Can I trust you? Then you have the highest part of the brain, which is the neocortex, the executive functioning, which allows us to engage in creativity, creative thinking, etc. What most people don't know, Jasper, is that the higher parts of the brain can't function until the lower part of the brain feels safe. So by using, in my case, what I use is heart-focused breathing. There are many wonderful types out there, vagal nerve breathing, box breathing. You can do any variety that you like. But the idea is that you then re-access your higher brain function by dropping into a breathing state, so that way your reactivity doesn't have the conversation. How many times have you had it, Jasper, where all of a sudden somebody says something that triggers you and you are not coming from your unconditional love, compassion, you're pissed, you're angry, right?
Often.
So that's often. Your amygdala. Your amygdala is running the show. So if we can learn to quiet the amygdala and reconnect to the higher brain function, that allows for deeper compassion and more meaningful connection with ourselves and others.
Mm. And you achieve that through breath work and meditation.
Absolutely, every day.
Yeah. Wow, beautiful. Now that's the reactive me. Sometimes I have when I receive an email that I don't like, want to send it back immediately, but I try to make a pause. Is this also connected? Because you talk about the golden path of connection. I saw it on Instagram.
Yeah.
Can you share a little bit, bit about it? And is it related to what you just shared about the brain, or is it a different thing?
Absolutely. It's 100% the same. So one day I had a download a few months ago that there's this thing I call the golden triangle of connection. So if you want to imagine that this lower part here is the connection to yourself, then you have the part over here, which is connection to others, and then you have the top of the triangle, which is connection to purpose.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing falls down, Jasper, if you don't first have that meaningful connection to yourself. It's like a house of cards. It comes tumbling down. When we have that meaningful connection to ourselves, that allows for connection to others in a meaningful way and allows for connection to our purpose. And that all begins with tools for self-regulation and resilience.
So it starts with self, then others, and then purpose.
And they're all interconnected. I say that it starts with the connection to self, though really they are all interconnected, but really you can't have any of it. People say, oh, I've actually debated this with a couple therapist friends of mine. And a therapist friend of mine said, well, Jen, I don't feel that connected to myself, but I'm there for others.
Mm.
Now, here's what I would argue. If you're out there listening and you're like my friend who I had this conversation with, I would say this. If you're not deeply connected to and grounded in yourself, and say I can be there for you and I can listen for you as a friend, but I'm not connected to myself, there's still going to be an energy of taking. Remember how I was just saying about taking?
Mm-hmm.
We're taking energy. So I might give you advice or I might listen to you, but if I'm not grounded and whole, complete, and perfect in myself, then I am at some way or another going to perhaps judge your experience or use it, or it could show up in a way where, let's say somebody out there is listening right now and they're like, well, Jennifer, that's not true. I'm not connected to myself. If I am trying to be there for a friend, at some level, there is a taking energy, because if I'm not whole, complete, and perfect and don't see you as whole, complete, and perfect, then there's going to be a disconnect and an imbalance of energy, right? And so that's one of my favorite things, is to help people understand you are whole, complete, and perfect, and I am whole, complete, and perfect.
Mm.
And when we come from that, look at relationships. That's why so many people are angry or upset. You're dealing with upset 4-year-olds, not upset 43-year-olds, because people have not connected to themselves and they don't know that. I know my triggers. I'm not perfect, but most of the time now, if I know something could be triggering, I'll number one, communicate it to the people I work with, my friends, the people I love, and I'll tell them, hey guys, I've noticed my lack of sense of belonging is something I'm working on. And so if you notice I get triggered by that, can we use a word like watermelon to help ground me? But if I don't know that and you say something that triggers me, then I could have a meltdown like a 3-year-old.
Yeah. So it starts with connection to self, connection to others, and it's important to be aware of your triggers and communicate it with others that you want to relate with. And in relationships, as you mentioned, I think you are married to someone from, you're American, right?
Yeah.
You're married to someone from Israel?
Yes.
I'm curious about relating, to what extent does coming from a different culture add to the complexity, or does it make things even more fun or excitement, or how does this work in your opinion?
You know, the only downside I would say being married to an Israeli is that when he and I don't speak Hebrew, so when he and his mom would talk, I would be worried that they were fighting, because they'd be talking like this at the top of their lungs. And I'd be like, honey, oh my gosh, please don't yell at your mom. He's like, no, honey, I was telling her I love her.
Okay. So they're very passionate talkers.
Yeah, very like Italiano, very passionate people, very lovely. Though in general, because I've spent the last...
Maybe similar to Yaren from this studio.
Yeah.
He can also talk very passionately.
Yeah, very passionate. There's nothing wrong with passion. And how do you not take passionate personally? That's another good question. So when it comes to my husband and I, we have an agreement, which is every night before bed, we say to one another, did I cause you pain today? And the point is, if you did cause the other person pain, then you share the other person will share how you caused them pain. And you never say, you caused me pain. You never say, you did this. Say, I noticed I felt triggered when. I noticed that it occurred for me like. And then once you share that, then the other person does not defend themselves. They say, I apologize. Please forgive me. Thank you for being in my life so that I may love you, which is a Ho'oponopono prayer. And that is how we be sure that nothing's ever on the glass between us, so that way nothing festers and comes up years later. And luckily, you know, we rarely fight. It's very, sometimes there'll be something mundane or silly that we'll have a disagreement about. But for the most part, it's a pretty calm, peaceful relationship.
So it's about speaking, asking, did I cause you pain? And then speaking about it more daily if that happens.
Yeah.
To have micro adjustments. You mentioned the prayer, the Bono prayer?
Ho'oponopono prayer.
Is it from Hawaii or something?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I heard it in the past, but I don't remember. So please share what is it and why is it useful?
So many, many years ago, Julian, again, my co-founder, was my coach at the time, and I had something I was so pissed about, so angry at the time, Jasper. You know when you're just enraged, like you could fry an egg on your head and steam's coming out your ears? That's how pissed I was about this thing. And Julian says to me, here's what I want you to do. I want you to think of the person every day for 30 days. You don't say it to them. You say it while thinking of them. In my husband, in my case, we say it to one another. But in general, you say the Ho'oponopono while thinking of someone. And you say out loud, I apologize. Please forgive me. Thank you for being in my life so that I may love you. So as you say that, you would say that over and over 10 times a day, at least for 30 days. Well, when you're pissed at somebody, it's like spitting venom. You're like, I apologize. Please forgive me, because you're saying it out loud, right? And at the end of those 30 days, the first time I ever said it, all of a sudden the conflict I was in with somebody else, it was the only time I ever got close to being in any sort of legal issue with anybody while I was running my first company, got completely dissipated. And that person and I are still friends now, 10 years later. So where it came from was, I believe it was a doctor or administrator of a hospital who popularized it. So he was running, I think it was a mental asylum or wellness place in Hawaii. And every day he would say it for every one of his patients. So much so, Jasper, that at the end of 3 years, he had no patients left because they had all healed.
Oh, wow. That's a very effective method.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah, I like these wisdoms from different places. So in Portugal, I once picked up a hitchhiker. Aww. And she gave me this symbol from the New Zealand Maori culture.
Oh, beautiful.
And it stands for prosperity. She was hitchhiking. She didn't have money. I just bought a Jeep. And then I also had an Airbnb. So she stayed in my Jeep for 2 nights.
Aww.
And then 5 days later, I encountered her and I received this this symbol. So yeah, what do you have an item in your life that symbolizes a certain experience that you want to memorize through an item?
Wow, that's a great question. I have two items, one that I buy in bulk because it's so meaningful to me that I give it to other people. It's called Mini Zohar or Mini Pinhas. I have one in my bag, but I won't go grab it right now. It's basically a little blue Kabbalistic book that's an ancient healing and protection prayer. And I've probably given away 10,000. And on both of the schools that I built, I put them at the base of the school. So I never hold on to them because what happened was years ago, two friends both gave me one in the same week. And that was what spawned my interest in Kabbalah. And so what I found was it brought me so many miracles and such joy that I never hold on to one and I would always give it away. So that's how I wound up buying them by the thousands to share with people. So that's one. And then I have another special item that my sister once gave me. And it has a little special saying on it that I since learned came from Neil Donald Walsh. And it said, let this be your greatest task. Let this be your greatest joy. To give people back to themselves, even in their darkest hour, especially in that hour. And that bracelet holds very special meaning to me.
Wow, that's beautiful. And then let this be your greatest task. Does it also refer to what you're doing in the moment is your greatest task?
Yeah, I truly feel that bracelet, that charm is everything. I mean, that is my purpose, to give people back to themselves, even in their darkest hour, especially in that hour, because I've had so many people do that for me. My dear friend, Dr. Mark Golston, who just passed away December 31st, saved my life when I was going through the divorce, all in the same year. It was like a 1-2-3 punch. Sold my first company, went through a divorce, and got diagnosed as being on the spectrum all in the same year.
Oh, wow.
It was a particularly adventurous and challenging year, but it was also the year I met my now husband and that miracles happened. So
I'm curious with your purpose, because you could translate it to an activity that also generates money, your business or what we call work. But your purpose can also express itself in non-financial matters. But how do you translate your purpose to your daily activities, if you understand what I mean?
It's funny you bring this up, Jasper. A dear friend of mine and one of my mentors, Jocelyn Herman Saccio, has a popular podcast called Be Unmessable With, all one word, Be Unmessable With. And she and I were recently doing a podcast, and I was sharing with Joss how I was bifurcating my attention. I have, you know, podcasting Jen, and then I have business Barbie Jen, who's out there doing that. And then I have wife Jen, and then I have friend Jen, and then I have travel Jen. And Joss said to me, Jen, do you understand that you're going to exhaust yourself if you keep bifurcating your attention and your energy like that? She said, the bigger question is, who are you being? And what does that give you in terms of your purpose? And that's when I realized that who I'm being is contribution and being somebody who brings connection to everybody I meet. And if that's the overlying purpose, then that informs the business, that informs the travel, that informs my marriage and my friendships. But it's not me trying to cut myself up into a million little pieces and put myself back together again. It is the undercurrent of everything I do.
I see. Yeah. There's an undercurrent that translates to certain form. And you mentioned that you have a bunch of activities. Sometimes you can expand your numbers of activities and sometimes you can contract, right? Do you feel balanced right now, or do you feel you want to remove something from your plate, or where are you right now in this activity level?
Well, I have two secrets to that. Would you like to know what they are?
I want to know. Yes, of course.
One is what I call my anti-jerk prayer. Would you like to hear the anti-jerk prayer?
I want to know. Yes, of course.
So this is how I remove anything or anyone who is not my highest and best good. This includes anything, to your point of being overwhelmed. I say out loud every day, universe, please remove anything or anyone who is not in my highest and best good. Give me the wisdom to know what's happening for my good and draw the right people and resources towards me. So I say that every day. The other thing I say out loud every day is I say, universe, please know I'm going to make plans with the highest and best of intentions. However, if for any reason the plans I'm making are not my highest and best good or that of humanity, please lovingly redirect me to the right plans. So I don't try to control it at all. I just live in a flow state where I just trust the right people, the right opportunities come to me. And then the jerks get zapped.
That's an amazing strategy. So it's kind of with the intention setting, you already do it. Yeah, it's an interesting one. Sometimes I add activities to my plate and sometimes I take a moment to remove something. So next week I have a conversation where I will remove something from my plate. But it's a challenge for many, many people. If you look at saying no, is that something you say often, or do you, with your approach that you just shared, you don't end up in many situations where you need to say no?
There's another piece of the puzzle I haven't mentioned. So one of my Kabbalistic teachers, David Guillaum, taught me years ago to speak out loud to the universe, source, Gaia, whatever, higher self, call it whatever you will. So my last step of my morning routine and practice is after I've done meditation, heart-focused breathing, inner child work, the very last step I do is I talk out loud to the universe. And I will literally ask about business deals. I will ask about, like this morning I said, universe, is it in my highest and best good to go do this podcast with Jasper today? I heard yes. And then I'll ask a second question, is the podcast going to happen? So it's a two-part thing. And part of this is I'm cross-checking my intuition. And I'd say about 80% of the time, I'm pretty accurate about it. And so I'll ask, is this meeting going to happen? Is it in my highest and best good for this meeting to happen? And if I hear no, I've literally canceled trips. I've canceled meetings. So I just live my life in a state of alignment and flow.
That's amazing. And you do that on a daily basis?
Every day.
Beautiful. And you don't feel guilty if you cancel something last minute?
No, because then it wasn't in their highest and best good or mine. And I always tell people, hey, I have a feeling today is not a great day. Is there a possibility for us to reschedule or postpone?
I see.
It's in a very soft way. It's not like, hey, I hate you and I heard you're not good for me. And it might just be wait. Sometimes I hear yes. Sometimes I hear no. Sometimes I hear wait. And so sometimes it just means that you need to wait for the right timing. As David always tells me, doing the right thing at the wrong time is still the wrong thing.
Yeah. Can you repeat that?
doing the right thing at the wrong time is still the wrong thing.
I think that's brilliant advice. Yeah, it needs to be right thing, right timing, right? Talking about timing and life shifts, I think 4 years ago you moved to Portugal.
Yeah.
And you came from New York?
I was living in Paris before this.
Ah, Paris. And before Paris?
London.
And before London?
New York/LA.
Okay. So if you look at New York, LA, London, Paris, Portugal, can you share a little bit? Because I'm always interested, I love travel, about your geographical movements and why they happened and what it brought you.
Yeah, so LA I'd lived in for many years, and I sold my company in 2018 and didn't have to live in LA. It was the first time most of my adult life that I didn't have to be anywhere or do anything. I could consult from anywhere around the world. My husband at the time was living in New York, and so we just first started off by kind of getting situated in New York, and then I moved to London. During the pandemic, we actually had a year of travel planned. We were supposed to spend a month in Bali, a month in the south of France, a month in South Africa, a month all around the world. And unfortunately, of course, COVID happened, and when COVID hit, I had a year's worth of trips already planned, paid for, et cetera. And COVID hits, and then I'm like, oh, crap. And I was in Paris at the time. I was like, I got to get myself to an English-speaking country. But my apartment was all packed up. I was not planning to go back to the U.S. I was like, screw this. I'm still going to have an adventure. So I packed up my bags and went from Paris to London when everything went crazy on March 12th of 2020, and then found myself living in London very unexpectedly for 6 months. People complain about London, but my God, living there during COVID was magical. Oxford Street was completely wide open, parks and sunshine. I would go feed the parrots in the park. It was a funny story about that. When I interviewed Deepak about the first interview we did about Total Meditation, his book that came out at the time, there's a story in the book of a woman who comes up to Deepak at a conference and says, Deepak, I want to show you something. And he's like, okay. She said, you need to come outside with me. He says, okay. So they sit down outside, and this woman sits on a bench, and birds start randomly landing on her, wild birds. And the moment I read that, clear as a bell, Jasper, I was like, I want that. And Deepak says to her, how are you doing this? And she says, bird consciousness. And I was like, I love trying to do challenging and unusual things. So when I moved to London, I remembered that. And I remember one day I was walking by this tree, a fig tree in St. James Park, just on the other side of this bridge. And this woman is feeding a wild parrot, a little wild parakeet. And I was like, how are you doing this? And she said, well, they like figs and they like nuts. So I was like, I wonder if I could. Now, it wasn't that much of an exciting thing because sometimes parakeets will randomly land on people. So I would sit there with my hands out, and I have pictures of myself in 2020 covered in 10 parakeets that are all eating like seeds and different things out of my hands. But I remember the one day that I was like, yes, I did it. I was literally sitting out there, standing there in the park, and I had parrots on me and different things. And then this little itty bitty blue tit bird lands on me and starts taking seeds out of my hands. And then this bigger, big brown blackish bird lands on me. And I was like, yes, mission accomplished. So then I was out of time that I could spend in London, and nowhere was open yet. It was still relatively closed. All of Europe was closed. So I'm in meditation one day, and I said, universe, where would you like me to go? Paris. I'm like, universe, I can't get into Paris. I'm a U.S. citizen. Legally, I'm not allowed in. The universe says, don't worry, just start to make plans. And I'm like, what? So I'm like, okay, fine. So I start making plans, and I had a dog, and I was like, okay, well, if my dog and husband and I were going to go to Paris, how would we get there? Well, you couldn't take the dog on the Eurorail train, Eurostar. You couldn't take the dog on a flight at that point. And I was like, well, I wonder how. So I Google, how do you get a dog to Paris from London? Pet taxi.
Pet taxi.
I swear to God. Pet taxi. So I look it up. It turned out the only legal way that a U.S. citizen could get into Europe at that time was taking a drive under the English Channel, which is what this pet taxi did. And next thing you know, I found myself living in Paris. So then similarly, I had known I'd liked Portugal. I'd been there earlier that year. One day I'm living in Paris, and we were supposed to be there till the end of October, early November. And when our lease was paid, we had a beautiful place in Saint-Germain. I love Paris, but they had been going through a lot of shutdowns and reopenings. And so one day I'm meditating, universe, do you still want me to go to Portugal? Yes. Universe, do you still want me to go to Portugal on November 1st? No. Universe, what day would you like me to go to Portugal? October 24th. okay.
October 24th.
Yeah, 2020. So again, when I do these out loud things, I also verify over multiple days. I'll double check to be sure it's not my ego mind that's answering. So fast forward, I ask for 3 or 4 days and I tell my husband, honey, I'm so sorry, but I think we have to leave our lease early and go to Portugal on October 24th. And luckily he knows my intuition's pretty good. He said, of course, my love, whatever you want. He's such a good sport. So we give up our lease early. We fly out on October 24th from Paris to Lisbon. The next day they shut down Paris in their third largest lockdown and we wouldn't have been able to get out.
Oh, wow. The next day.
Yeah. The 25th of October of that year.
That's crazy. Yeah. How this information flow works.
Yeah.
Wow. And how, so when you ask for the universe, is it like a voice that you hear or like, is it a knowing?
It's a great question. And I remember my husband and I were walking along the Teju River one day and he said, honey, what does God's voice sound like? And I was like, you can call it God, higher self, source, call it whatever you prefer that honors you. And so for me, I hear a voice and it's non-gender. It's not male. It's not female. It's just a very clear voice. And it normally comes from my heart, not my head. That's where I hear it from. A lot of other people I know experience it differently. They'll feel it bodily. They'll feel like it's somewhere in their body, like in their heart or in their belly or in their gut or whatever it is. For me, I just somehow or another have realized that I've developed this clairaudience of ability to hear yeses and nos and things that I never thought I'd be able to hear.
That's beautiful how you trust your intuition and universe guidance. And if you look at New York and LA on the one hand, your US experience, and then Paris, London, Portugal, you mentioned look in the good things of people and places, right? So what do you like about the US? And what do you like about Europe?
What I like about the U.S., I'm laughing because living in the U.S., it's very capitalistic. It's very go, go, go. You want to build something. You want to conquer nations, take over and destroy things. U.S. is very good for that, like, tough energy. When I moved to Portugal and started building a new company, I remember I was getting ready to do my first ever fundraising call. And because the energy in Portugal is so soft and peaceful and easy, I literally, before fundraising calls, would put on Eminem's, like his 8 Mile song, and be like shadow boxing to Eminem to try and get my energy up. Because when I was in LA, it was so natural. And I remember one day I'm sharing this with my dear friend and accountability buddy, KJ. And she's like, Jen, the reason you didn't have to do that in LA is because you were Eminem when you're living in LA. Because it's just more that like thrust and hard energy. So now I actually find it more challenging to go back to the US because it's so chaotic and messy and just all over the place. So I like the softness of Europe and the flow of it. For me, from a time zone standpoint, I love that most of my meetings don't start unless I'm doing meetings with Asia or Australia. Most days my meetings don't start till 12 or 1. So I get to luxuriate in my 2-hour morning meditation practice, take the dog for a walk, have breakfast with the husband if we have time, and maybe get a massage if I want it, and then dive in all my meetings. And then I'm on late meetings. But it's just nice to have the reverse schedule.
I see. And do you think America should have a little less of, or what would you like to change?
I would love to see a little bit more compassion and acceptance of other people's views. I think Europe does that a little better. Not all of Europe, you know, it has its own flavors based on the country. Though I go back to the US now and I feel the divisiveness. There's just so much anger and animosity and divisiveness amongst people in the same families and friendships and businesses. And if I could gift the United States something, it would be compassion and understanding and acceptance. Yeah.
I think it's also a bit, if you look at the political system, I don't know too much about it, but in the Netherlands, we have maybe 15 political parties and you always need like 3 or 4 parties to form a majority government. Mm. So the consensus is really built into the system. But in the US, because you have these two big parties, it's always one or the other. Right? So in the system, it already starts like that. I don't know. Do you think it has to do with it, or is it something different?
I think part of it is political. I think part of it's how the US was based. The US was based in an adversarial way where it was fighting with London and trying to gain its independence. and destroy other people and lives and the Indians who live there. So I think the seed level with which you do anything is going to bear the fruit, just like we talked about earlier. Because the seed level of the U.S. was, you're not the boss of me, I'm going to do what I want, and I'm going to take what I want, then a certain tree is born of that energy. Versus if the seed level of something is cooperation, then you have a different tree or fruit that gets born.
I see. So it's the seed that is very important. Yeah. U.S. attracts a lot of also adventurous people, right? Entrepreneurial people. What I like about the U.S. is definitely the ability to dream big. You know, people go for their dreams. What I like less is sometimes standardization. You have like Pete's Coffee everywhere. Mm. McDonald's is a bit like the standardization. But anyways, is there any other destinations on your list? Or do you feel a little bit like staying for a while in Portugal, or you don't know, you take it more day by day?
Wherever the universe puts me. I never know where I'm going to go. Again, being a projector, I wait to be invited sometimes. That's how I came to Portugal. The first time was a friend said, oh, you should go to Portugal when you're in Europe. Yeah. And next year, I would love to go to Antarctica. It's been on my bucket list for a while. Wow. So would love to, not to live there, of course. I had a friend who lived there who's a scientist. But Antarctica is on my bucket list. The world is just one big oyster to explore. So
it is. And related to consciousness and wisdom, have you ever been attracted to more Asian regions? Or?
Yeah, I love Cambodia. So I built my first school in Nepal in 2017. Yeah, 2017. And then built the second school in Senegal in 2019. Loved
in
Nepal.
Senegal?
So I built a school in Nepal and one in Senegal. And I just love the Nepalese people. Just such warm, kind people. I love the Cambodian people. I looked at building a school there about 10, 15 years ago. And love the Cambodians. Vietnam was not my favorite because I was deathly ill that whole trip. I've been to, last year, I got to speak in front of 100,000 people in India, which was extraordinary. So I was in India, Sri Lanka was amazing, Singapore and Thailand last year.
100,000, was it like a soccer stadium or where
it was huge. It was in the middle of this big open land. A friend of mine has something called the Pyramid Spiritual Society Movement, where every year a million people gather together and they food and house a million people so that we can meditate together for 3 hours every morning from 5 a.m. to 8 a.m.
Wow, that's amazing. How does it feel to speak in front of 100,000 people?
Fun.
Yeah, fun?
Yeah. It's not me, honestly, Jasper. When I'm doing this interview with you and your audience, when I'm speaking, if it's me, then little Jennifer Hill is going to have her own myopic, egoic point of view of things. So I do the best I can to surrender my ego and just be of service. So I think if I was more worried about the me showing up, then it would be more jarring. But I think because it's not me, it's just my higher consciousness, I leave it to my higher consciousness and source to do the interviews on my behalf.
Yeah. So whether it's 1,000 people or 100,000 people, it's
it makes no difference.
Yeah. Talking about building the school, how do you approach such a project and how do you ensure that it's a sustainable project within the local ecosystem? Because, I mean, now you're in Portugal and you're not with the schools. Like, how does that work?
Yeah, that's why I gave up on building schools. In 2012, I think it was, is when the first time I went to Cambodia to build my first school, and a friend of mine had built a school there. And I showed up and it's $35,000 to build a school. And the World Bank will match it, which is enough to get a school going. But when I went, the guy I was going to give the money to, I didn't trust that it was going to go to the kids. So I gave up for about 6-7 years after that. And fast forward, one day I'm in a thought leadership group in Monterey, California. And this young man sitting next to me says, Jennifer, what matters to you? I said, building schools. He said, great, what are you doing about it? Said, I gave up on that dream. It was too complicated. To your point, how do you ensure? How do you make sure the kids get the money? How do you be sure the kids go to the school? He said, I want you to share that. So he had me stand up, and in front of 100 people, I shared, I'm committed to building schools, and I don't know how. And this woman stands up, Linda Bird, just across the room, and she says, call Skylar at Buildon on Monday. And I did. And Buildon is a phenomenal organization that not only builds schools in Asia, in Mexico, and Central America, in Africa, but they also help United States kids with getting to 96% graduation rates from high school. And so they had a whole system in place where they create relationships with the ministries of education, with the tribes people. They get the local villagers to agree to send their boys and girls in equal amounts to the schools. And it was extraordinary. My mom, dad, and ex-husband and I built the first school in Nepal, And then my dad and I, and my dad passed away this February, we got to build a school together, just the two of us in Senegal. And you raise the money and then you go physically build the school. And it's hard work. There is no running water, no toilets, nothing, no air conditioning. And you do it because it's to be of service.
Beautiful. That's beautiful. Yeah. The reason why I'm asking, I was in Tanzania. So when I was 3 months old, we moved to Tanzania. My parents were going to work there as doctors. But actually, my mom passed away. We had a car accident, unfortunately. And then 4 years ago, I spent 4 months in Tanzania. And I was going back to the place where we lived. And I met people that knew about the accident. And he said, we can do a ceremony. So I brought like some books, some pencils for the school. And I brought some money for beers for everyone so that we had ceremony with dancing and speaking. It was very touching. But they were also smart. Someone was coming to me and he looked at me, Jasper, I know that you come back to build a school. He was telling me, but it kind of touched something in me. So I never forgot about it. But then recently I was reflecting on it because sometimes I get a message from someone from Tanzania. So I was contemplating on it. But then my concern is that it's not like sustainable, right? So that's why I was asking.
You have to have relationships with the local ministries of education.
Yeah.
You have to have what they do at Buildon is they have the chief and every man and woman in the village either sign their name or put a fingerprint or some sort of mark to be able to show that they agree to send their kids and that they promise to send them to school.
And I'm curious because you need, stones, let's say the physical things. Then you need like teachers.
Rebar, cement.
Yeah, right. And then you need the students. But what is the main challenge in creating a kind of sustainable school?
I think it is the relationships, really. I mean, even Tony Blair's people, I got introduced to them. And they had an interesting model that they were using to build schools where they didn't even have like a structure. It was more that they had remote internet access and ways that the students could be taught from teachers anywhere around the world. So I thought that was a cool model too. One of my other friends, Michelle, out of Brazil, has a company called Tubi Live, I think it is, that provides access to Zoom-like access to the remotest parts of the world that have no Wi-Fi, no 5G or 3G, and still gets to stream stuff. So I think the future of schools in other worlds and other parts of the country will be utilizing technology and the commitment from the local villagers, like to give the local villagers incentives to send their kids to school.
Yeah. So relationships and incentives, because otherwise they don't even go to the school.
Correct.
Yeah, that's something I didn't think about. But yeah, they need to go to the school, right? Yeah. To actually have a school. Yeah.
And you're taking the kids away from farming. That's the thing you have to keep in mind. Like where I was in Nepal or in Senegal, those kids, you're taking time away from what they would normally be doing, helping run the farm or the village or the compound.
From economic activity. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, thank you for sharing these thoughts. I'll think about it, whether I still want to go build a school. So my last question, or maybe I have two more questions, is I ask everyone. So based on your life experience, you've been around for, I think, 43 years, right? Mm-hmm. You mentioned. So what is your recipe for life?
The recipe for life is to pause before you speak or act and to engage with everybody you meet, including yourself, from a place of compassion.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Pause. Compassion. And then maybe my last question, is there anything else you want to share with the listeners?
A few weeks ago, I was having a very, very challenging day. You know those days, Jasper, where you're on your hands and knees crying and fighting and saying, crap, why am I going through all of this, right? And I share this for two reasons. One, I meet a lot of people who think, oh, you have it all together. You pray, you meditate, you know, you do all the things. You have a happy relationship. You have friendships. You still have shit days sometimes. And I recorded actually this thing. I tried to get myself to the Pilates studio. There's a studio I rent and I teach myself when I'm there. And I literally fell to my knees. I couldn't even continue the workout because I was so crushed, Jasper, like just by everything I was going through at that moment in my life. And I recorded this little memo to myself, this voice memo that was as much to me as it was to every entrepreneur, every friend I've ever had who's gone through this. And it went something like this. Dear entrepreneur, please know there are going to be times where you are going to be angry and enraged, where you're going to feel like you have nothing left, where everything feels like it is failing. Dear entrepreneur, when you're angry, when you're sad, when you're upset, it's in those moments that you must allow yourself to feel your feelings so that they don't consume you. Dear entrepreneur, there are going to be breakdowns in technology, breakdowns in relationships. There are going to be things that don't go your way and investors who say no. But dear entrepreneur, I want you to know that it's all worth it as long as you have the courage.
Beautiful. Wow. Thank you so much for sharing all your wisdom. It was such a fascinating conversation. And I keep following you and your adventures. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thank you, Jasper.
Thank you.